Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, we have a very unique podcast today. We're going to talk about eight films, and of the eight, we've only seen one of them together. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have a lot of solo reviewing to do, maybe some question asking, but I can't immediately tell you that you're wrong like I usually do.
That's right. You'll just have to presume that I am.
You provided the wine this evening, and it says, it's by a well-known company, Ménage à Trois Silk. Why did you bring Ménage à Trois?
I brought Ménage à Trois because it is in direct reference to a movie that I saw that you did not, which is called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, and the Wonder Women and Professor Marston are in a bit of a ménage à trois.
Ooh la la.
Yeah, so it was a no-brainer, actually, for revisiting this particular brand of wine for this evening.
All right, well, I want to kick off the podcast with what is going to be playing on the most screens this weekend and will most likely win the weekend financially is Happy Death Day, because the American public, for whatever reason, loves to go to horror films to get that little scare, that little jolt up the spine, even if the horror movies are terrible. And I'll put the bottom line up front. As you say, don't bury the lead, Charlie. Mm-hmm. Happy Death Day is terrible.
Of course it is.
It's terrible.
That's why I skipped it.
Because I do not watch previews or know anything about it, even I caught on in the first 2 minutes, this was Groundhog Day in the horror genre. She was going to repeat this day over and over.
Didn't we just have one of those?
We did earlier this year, but that was not horror genre Groundhog Day. That was teenage melodrama Groundhog Day called Before I Fall with Zoe Deutsch.
Right.
Also a terrible film. Do you remember back in La La Land, so long ago, we saw a movie called La La Land. Mm-hmm. Emma Stone had some roommates. Mm-hmm. One of those roommates was played by the actress Jessica Roth. Jessica Roth is now a leading actress. She gets her own movie, Happy Death Day. She is Tree Gelbman. Tree Gelbman is a sorority girl at a university. They don't name it, but it's Loyola down in New Orleans. And she's a terrible person. Just a terrible person. At the end of the first day, when she finally gets stabbed in the throat with a butcher knife, this guy was happy. Get rid of this girl. She's terrible to everyone around her. She doesn't answer her father's phone calls. She wakes up in the strange bed in a dorm room. It looks like she just had blackout drunk sex, but you're not sure. It's her birthday, so she keeps dying every day on her birthday, and her roommate every day gets her a cupcake, and she just throws it in the trash. At the end of every day, she is, I don't know, stabbed in the gut by a butcher knife, stabbed by a broken-apart bong, and it's not a slasher film. It's not a horror movie. It's a murder mystery. It's a whodunit. To get to finally the next day, her tomorrow, she figures out she has to find the identity of her killer. Who's the guy behind the mask killing her every day? I don't care. I didn't care. It's PG-13, so they're catering this to 13-year-olds, therefore you don't see the stabbing. It's mostly off-screen. You don't see any blood. There's nothing remotely scary about it. It's just a thrill that 13-year-olds can finally kind of, they don't even have to sneak into it. They can just walk in theater and see it. And it's all around terrible. The director is Christopher Landon. He produced Paranormal Activity 2, 3, and 4, and directed the worst one of that series, Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones. Anything about what I just said to you about Happy Death Day, you know, intrigue you?
No. In fact, I saw the poster, I saw the title, and I saw that it was competing with another screening for Professor Marston, I believe, that night. And so it was a given for me to skip Happy Death Day because I could tell right off the bat that it would be a waste of my time and I would miss something much better by going to see that one. So I'm very happy to have missed Happy Death Day.
I was intrigued. I loved the look of the movie poster. It's got this birthday cake. that says Happy Death Day on it, and a big butcher knife in there, and you can see the mask's reflection. You remember when Scream came out in the 90s, and that Scream mask showed up on Halloween for like 5 years, the next 5 years? I think they're doing the same with this mask. This mask's creepy looking. Like, you do not want to die. Staring at this mask is the last thing you ever see. So it's probably going to win the weekend. Everyone's going to go see it, but just know that it stinks.
There are so many things out there that why would it not divide the audience, hopefully? But then again, it's PG-13. So all those people who couldn't sneak into it or who avoided it because of its R rating, but like the horror genre, then, you know, maybe this one was supposed to help fill that gap. But it's a shame, because I would say if you like horror movies and you haven't seen it yet, gosh, go see it before you see Happy Death Day, even if you're a teenager.
We agree. But the first one I would like to hear about that you saw this week that I did not, and the one that's opening on the second widest screen will probably crack the top three, is The Foreigner, starring Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan. And, man, I know nothing about it, but looking at the poster...
posters. Well, see, that's just it. I knew nothing about it going in, and... it is a Jackie Chan movie. So a lot of the people who are in the crowd for the screening that I saw were from like the Martial Arts Club of DC or something. So they were all very excited to be going to see a Jackie Chan movie. What's really bizarre about The Foreigner is it's actually based on a novel called The Chinaman. And if you didn't know that going in, you actually wondered why they made all these references that seemed kind of un-PC to The Chinaman. And then if you realize it was based on a book, it makes a little more sense. But you also understand why they probably didn't title the movie that in today's day and age, it probably wouldn't have gone over so well. But what's very strange about this movie is it is a typical, in many ways, it's a typical revenge movie. And the Jackie Chan character is essentially like the Liam Neeson character in Taken. And so Jackie Chan plays this guy.
He has a certain set of skills.
He's got skills. And we all know what skills Jackie Chan has.
He's old now. Does he still have skills?
He's a 60-year-old with skills. But although Liam Neeson's probably, you know, the age
difference. He's probably older than that. Yeah.
Basically the movie kicks off and Mr. Kwan, played by Jackie Chan, his teenage daughter is killed in a terrorist bombing attack in London. And so Kwan, who is at the beginning seems like this very sort of modest businessman in London, ends up determined to find out who set off this bomb. And in the meantime, you've got Pierce Brosnan, who is channeling Jerry Adams, who's this former IRA person who's now working for the British government. Reminded me a lot of if you took that character from The Journey.
Love The Journey.
Right. So if you took that and fast forwarded 20 years to when you've got this person in the British government who has a background of having been involved in the IRA violence. And so some IRA affiliated fringe group takes responsibility for this bombing. And so the whole movie is like two different movies in one. You've got this typical revenge movie with Jackie Chan, and then you've got this sort of political thriller with the Pierce Brosnan character. And so the movie's kind of a mess in that regard, but it's still both Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan command the screen when they're on it. And so people enjoyed this movie while they were mocking it, and it was one of those ones where you have the interactive audience, people talking at the screen going, oh, no, here we go. Every time that you were poised for a fight scene with Jackie Chan, and people, you know, it's a high body count when he's involved. So if you like Jackie Chan movies or you like Pierce Brosnan political thrillers, just sort of close one eye at a time and watch this movie, and it's fine. It's just a meh political thriller
revenge
movie.
What a shock. You just said, it's fine.
It's fine. I knew. So that was just for you that I said, it's fine. But, you know, it is. It's just one of those ones where it's like, you know, you messed with the wrong 60-year-old Chinaman.
No, you don't want to be doing that.
And then there's this question throughout the film, Pierce Brosnan's character, which side he's on, if he is still an advocate of peace on, you know, between Northern Ireland and Britain. And so it's just one of those movies that will come and go if you for the action movie buff, but it's just a so-so movie in the end, and you'll go, you'll see it, you'll laugh a little, you'll be a little horrified at the premise. Sometimes it's a little preposterous, and then you'll move on to the next movie and completely forget about The Foreigner.
Yeah, I really don't have much to respond to you about this. I don't really have any questions. I don't want to know anything more because it just sounds blah. He did good descriptions of blah.
Yeah, it's directed by the same guy who did like Casino Royale, so he's got that sort of...
Casino Royale is an amazing movie.
Yeah, so he's got that action. It moves, you know, so it's a well-paced kind of flick. But he also did Green Lantern. So there you go. It's, you know, a little of everything.
It's kind of a step down from Casino Royale, in fact. That was a very big James Bond film.
Yeah, but a step up from Green Lantern. So you put it in the middle there. So it's somewhere in the middle of this guy's work.
All right, our next film is the only one this week we both saw, which is surprising. Like, we did not plan this. Like, I did not plan to see everything you did not see. Mm-hmm. But we both saw Marshall. Now, what makes this odd is that we knew it was coming. One day, they were finally going to make the big biopic of Thurgood Marshall. And this isn't it. They have yet to make the big biopic of Thurgood Marshall. But they got the guy who stars in the big biopics. They got Chadwick Boseman. Chadwick Boseman played Jackie Robinson in 42, and he played James Brown in Get Down. Both amazing performances. And his performance here as Thurgood Marshall is good, but it's limited because this is not Thurgood Marshall was born, he lived, and he died. This is one case in the life of Law and Order episode, Thurgood Marshall. It's a trial story, and half of it's Thurgood Marshall. He goes up to Connecticut to defend an African-American accused of a crime because of his race, because he's working for the NAACP, and that is what he does. He stands on platforms, he makes speeches, calls attention to it. And the other half of the film is funny man Josh Gad, a lawyer who really does not want to be involved in this trial, but kind of got shanghaied by Thurgood to do this, and it's... There are actually laughs in this kind of queasy, very racial, very tense trial. I gave this a marginal thumbs up, a 3-star. I got a kick out of it, Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had to twist your arm a little bit to actually show up for this one, though.
It was downtown.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm glad props for making it, and I think it's good that we both saw it. I agree, it is more, it's a courtroom drama, so it's almost a little bit of a Matlock, Shades of... To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, the case is remarkably similar to Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, so it has that sort of sense. But I guess I agree that it's not a Thurgood Marshall biopic. Mm-mm. So that can really throw people off because most people only really know Thurgood Marshall as the person who argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of the Brown versus Board of Education, which is, you know, this landmark case to integrate schools. And so, you know, that's an afterthought in this after this movie. This is taking something way back earlier in his career, and I would have called it something different. I mean, Josh Gad, I think, deserves a little more equal billing in this particular one because...
There's only one character on the movie poster.
Yeah, which is wrong because I think it's both of them. I would have called it like Thurgood and Samuel.
Marshall and me.
Marshall and me, yes, because Josh Gad's character, he's this sort of... schlubby Jewish lawyer who has only tried civil cases, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with this case. But the way that the courts, the judge in this particular case, won't allow Thurgood Marshall to argue the case, he has to have somebody who was a member of the Connecticut bar arguing this case, and so Josh Gad's character ends up being that person, and. There's an interesting dynamic. There's a budding friendship that's developing there about because of what was going on with World War II at the time and with the Holocaust happening over in Europe and the impact that that was having on both there was the racial and the religious stuff going on in the U.S. in 1940-41, I think, is when this case was supposed to be. And so it was just, it was interesting for that time period. It was like a period piece courtroom drama about these two lawyers who kind of worked together to try, you know, to defend this guy, this chauffeur who was accused of raping and attempted murder of his socialite employer, played by Kate Hudson, by the way. And so and Sterling K. Brown it's important to mention, plays the defendant.
The man from television stardom right now, Sterling K. Brown, who won an Emmy last year for The People vs. O.J. Simpson. He was Christopher Darden. Mm-hmm. And he is also Randall on This Is Us.
Absolutely.
He makes my wife cry about every other week.
Yes, indeed.
He gets his moment to shine.
He is having quite the year, and he comes off very different in this. It took me a second to actually realize. It's like, oh, that's Randall. And so I think he does very well. I mean, it's just definitely...
Tell me it's fine.
It was good. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? People learn a little bit more about Thurgood Marshall, and next time they're at BWI Airport, they'll actually know...
Thurgood Marshall Airport?
It is called Thurgood Marshall, Baltimore Washington International Airport. And he was the first Black Supreme Court justice, and it's important that people know his name. And so for a new generation, even if this is just giving them a introduction to Thurgood Marshall, hopefully we will eventually get a more definitive biopic that gives him his due sort of over the years. And I remember when he retired, he just was one of those guy justices that I just found to be kind of a hoot. I remember he said he was retiring because he was old and falling apart. That was when somebody asked him, why are you retiring? That was his response. And he had quite the storied career. And so this is just one small part of it, but it did play very much like a To Kill a Mockingbird or just an episode of a very good Law and Order.
Well, the choice for director here is a little odd. He used to direct films way back, I think the first House Party in 1990, and then Boomerang, I remember that from 92, starring Eddie Murphy, and even an SNL spinoff, The Ladies' Man, got my cabassier, Reginald Hudlin, and after that, he just kind of directs television episodes, most TV you probably know, but one or two episodes, and just bounces around, and here he's taking on Marshall, and some of this stuff is actually choppy. You mentioned that early World War II backdrop, and there's a... we see Harlem in a jazz club, and there's Langston Hughes and a guy who's supposed to be August Wilson, I thought, but they don't name him.
They called him August.
They called him August, so you extrapolate, all right, that's probably August Wilson. Did you notice, right when they were kind of setting that scene, they used this stock footage from Times Square just to set the stage, and it's this grainy thing that could have been in any PBS thing, and like, why is this in here? What are you doing? I don't need this. What a choppy thing to do.
It was not the best directed film, so it might have suffered a little bit at the hands of a somewhat green movie director.
Or at least out of practice.
Out of practice, because there were no real dramatic spikes in this movie, and that was sort of one of the problems, too, is that it was a courtroom drama, but very light on the drama.
He threw in some melodrama, and I didn't know Thurgood Marshall as a young man. I have no idea if he threw down in bars against really large white supremacist dudes. Maybe he did. Maybe he was a brawler. I doubt it. But so that one seems like a stretch when he just like, all right, that's it. Let's go.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that Josh Gad's character, Samuel Friedman, probably deserves to have been known just as much for this particular case, because Thurgood Marshall could not have won this particular case without the help of Sam Friedman.
I learned the writer is a father-son duo of writers. The father of that duo is a lawyer, so this is his first screen credit because, son needed the help on the law stuff. New Samuel Friedman.
Oh.
Like, you remembered him. And it's not, Josh Gad looked nothing like him. He was actually a svelte guy. But, Michael and Jacob Koskoff wrote this.
Yeah, so, it's not a great movie, but it's solid.
All right, we've mentioned it a couple of times now in our wine, directly links to it. It's not a limited release, but the other film this week, just like Marshall, opening on around 1,000 screens, so it's in a city near you, but just not everywhere, is Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, which is, tell me why there's a second movie this year referencing Wonder Woman.
Well, the scary thing is that if anyone goes into this sort of riding the coattails of the success of Wonder Woman, expecting to see a very lighthearted origin story, they're in for a shock, because this is Professor Marston was the American psychologist from Harvard credited with creating the Wonder Woman character, the iconic superhero. And he had two muses, one of whom was his wife, and the other of whom was his mistress, who was a grad student, who also then, according to the interpretation of events in this particular biopic, the two women were also involved. So this was thus the menage a trois wine. And it was a little bit like a 50 Shades of Grey meets Big Love and Sister Wives. So anyone who really enjoyed, you know, I remember with Big Love with Bill Paxton, and his character was sympathetic and the women were sympathetic. You like everybody. You know, even though it's kind of an icky premise in some regard, they kind of pull it off. And that somehow they kind of make it okay. But the idea in Professor Marston's mind was that his wife, was a very strong woman, sort of a dominant, and the other woman, Olive Byrne, was more of a submissive type. And his whole theory was basically you put them together and you've got like the perfect woman. And so they were both wonder women in their own way. And you put all their qualities together and you ended up with this perfection. But,
you know, one way to look at that is women by themselves as an individual are incomplete.
No, but it doesn't come off that way. And so it was fascinating. It was one of the most thought-provoking and discussion-provoking films I've seen in a long time, where people came out of it and you were all talking about it and talking about the interpretation of it. And we're talking about, this is the 1930s and 40s that this is going on. And so they were living openly. They had several kids
between
them.
Openly.
They were pretty much. And the whole film is kind of the backdrop is that Professor Marston is called before censors who censor children's literature. And they're saying that these comic books and their depictions of bondage and domination and things like that, that Wonder Woman is, you know, actually the dominant one in his comics. And they felt that it was harmful. These popular comics were harmful to children. And so they kind of flash back throughout the film where you can see where his inspiration for various things came from and the qualities that he was drawing off of. And so, you know, Olive was his grad student, and Professor Marston and his wife, who also was a psychologist, I believe, or didn't get her degree in that era, but had the academic credentials. The two of them are sort of credited with inventing one of the first lie detector tests. And so part of the film is
that the lasso of truth?
Well, so apparently that actually you would assume that there was some connection, but some of the stuff that I read actually since has indicated that that was a byproduct. That actually was not where the lasso of truth came from. But they do part of this film. It's like they're trying to perfect the lie detector and the biological mechanisms that would, you know, alter the readings. And so they use them on themselves, and that's how their relationship status kind of gets revealed. And it's really such a hard one to explain, but to market it, to sort of try and ride the coattails of the Wonder Woman success of that movie this year is a little weird.
The movie poster looks like Wonder Woman.
Yes, but, you know, this Luke Evans, who was Gaston in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
He's the one who plays Professor Marston. He's just very intriguing, and he plays it well. Rebecca Hall plays his wife, and we saw her last year in Christine.
I remember her from Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Yeah, so
I remember her from Christine.
And Christine, she was very good in that. So she plays his wife, Elizabeth. And then Bella Heathcote plays the grad student, Olive, that's involved with both of them. And ironically enough, she plays Layla in 50 Shades of Grey, so you'll be seeing
it's a
her
very
again.
Small character, at least if she's it's been very, in those movies yet.
I know,
I do not
but it was
her.
But I thought it was very funny that
wasn't she in Twilight.
She might have been, but I just thought it was funny that she actually does have a very brief role in 50 Shades, because this film will have your jaw dropping throughout some parts of it, but it's still it's a fascinating story.
Well, there's an interesting theme then going on here in the films we saw this week. The one I'm going to talk about now is the third biopic in a row, and it's another character origin story. I saw Goodbye, Christopher Robin. It's about A.A. Milne. And what, Hannah, what is staring at me right now?
I brought, just to boost your confidence in talking about this film, a Winnie the Pooh bear.
Winnie the Pooh
that
is staring at me.
I actually had at home. So Winnie is staring at us. He is our mascot for the night.
I had no idea. Winnie the Pooh and the 100-Acre Wood and Tigger and all that stuff was born out of World War One. The atrocities and barbarity of World War One. A.A. Milne returns from the Western Front, the trench warfare, just shaking and cowering of PTSD, and he returns to his wife, and he is having problems. Like, the slightest noise will set him off to flashbacks of artillery and thudding explosions, and so they said, you know what, let's make it all better and have a kid. And they were, I guess, born somewhere near British aristocracy. They're not, you know, nobility or anything, but they hire a nanny, and they let the nanny raise the kid. And they don't show any emotion, ever. You know, that's, you just, I guess British people back then just did not show feelings. They did not portray that they ever had feelings. So, Christopher Robin, his name is actually Billy, their kid is Billy, grows up, and he's far closer to his nanny. He knows there is a mother and a father, but they're always off on the mainland traveling or at parties in London. And then when they finally move out to the country, because Dad wants to write a book about peace, he's going to write a book that says, no more war. I'm gonna write the best thing ever. And he's blocked. He can't write it. And he just kind of stumbles on this wooded surrounding. They live in Sussex, and it looks like, you know, what you imagine the 100-acre wood looks like. And he gets this inspiration when he spends a little time with his kid, and they make up this backstory of his stuffed animal bear, and he gives it names, and there's the donkey Eeyore and Piglet. And, yeah, you see how Winnie the Pooh was born, and it explodes! I had no idea Winnie the Pooh was so big back then. I guess in the 1920s, it was... I don't know what the equivalent is today, but Harry Potter. It was Harry Potter back then. It was so big. And they turned their kid, Billy, Christopher Robin, into just a show pony, a monkey. They make him do all these guest appearances. He's not ready. He's like six. You know, he's not ready to do all this. And he's losing out on his childhood. And it's just really a story of bad parenting. It leaves a sour taste in your mouth. But by the end, oh my lord, the audience around me was vocally sobbing. Just
that's what I heard
when it got, you know, kind of quiet towards the climax. I could just hear just open just straight people were turning to puddles because it gets sad. I'm not gonna lie, it gets sad. I might have had a little frog in my throat in there, but it's not a good movie. Yeah, I just give it a complete thumbs down, 2 stars. This is just not a good movie. I'm not sure I like watching movies about bad parents and the trauma they inflict on their children, and it's just another boring, oh, okay, so that's where Winnie the Pooh came from. I don't care.
So is it one of those ones that just kind of emotionally manipulates you at the end, so you leave there with the feels even though you didn't have them through 90% of the movie?
Yeah, you kind of have little feel. While it starts in the present and goes flashbacks, you already kind of know what happens. And then, man, they turn the screws on you. Something bad. It's directed by a man named Simon Curtis. He did Woman in Gold. If you remember that one, he did My Week with Marilyn, a much better movie, by the way. This one's not, I wouldn't say, like, who's it for? It's for people that like Winnie the Pooh. It's not for people that like Winnie the Pooh, because, it's for people that like to cry in movie theaters. There are other people like to go and just cry.
But there are. And so I wasn't sure. I was very conflicted. I absolutely wanted to see this movie, and I had heard that it had a real emotional pull. And so I was curious about that. We were divided. It was another divided one where I really wish we probably should have switched, because I like a heavy dose of sap, and it sounds like this one would have had that for me.
Oh, this is like you. I saw this instead of The Foreigner, didn't I?
No, I think you saw this one instead of The Meyerowitz Story.
Oh, that's
Could have seen The Foreigner last night. two nights ago. I was curious to see it, but now if it doesn't have enough of I don't like just sad sap. I like more of your uplifting sap. So
yeah,
I don't know. You have to tell me which of those.
It's bittersweet. You know, I'm not going to give it away, but some people just really like to take their Kleenexes and just you will get a cleansing if you're that kind of person. You will just leave it.
Well, then that's
on the movie theater floor.
That's good, because then that's the type of movie I'd actually rather just see by myself, see it on the TV later.
Yeah, well, when you get the screener, let me know what happens to you. But
I hope I get the screener because I would like to see it in the privacy of my own home. Whereas I do think also more people will want to see Professor Marston in the privacy of their own home. And so it is interesting that both of these movies are coming out at the same time, where you just have the stories about the creators of certain characters and the time period and what, and just what influenced them. So it's kind of I think it's going to detract from both.
Well, this one's a slow and steady release. It's only on 8 screens this weekend, so it's not really direct competition with Professor Marston. Mm-hmm. It's going to, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, it'll expand nationwide.
Okay.
But yeah, I heard someone say once, you know what, don't make a movie about writers. It's boring. And you know what? I can see where they're coming from. Don't make a movie about writers.
Professor Marston, it wasn't just writing, it was drawings. And so there's a lot more visually intriguing, I would say, to that one. But while you saw Goodbye Christopher Robin, I went and saw The Meyerowitz Stories.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and I am bummed I didn't see The Meyerowitz Stories because it was made by Noah Baumbach. I love Noah Baumbach.
I sat here going, this Charlie and I should have switched.
But it's okay because it's on Netflix.
Yeah, so you can see it on Netflix, which is the better venue for this because I don't think you need to see it on the big screen. It is one of those thoughtful dramedies, much the same way While We're Young, which also had Ben Stiller in it. If you remember that one with Adam Driver.
One of my top 10 films of the year.
Then you would like The Meyerowitz Stories. A lot of people were very bored, honestly, in this screening because it was kind of slow. But it's a family dynamics drama, and it's a great cast. I mean, obviously Noah Baumbach likes to bring in the same people in all of his movies. So you have Ben Stiller, and then you also have Dustin Hoffman is in it as the father of Ben Stiller's character.
I can believe Dustin Hoffman has Ben Stiller's
father. And the other one, it's Adam Sandler in a very interesting, dramatic.
And he does drama every now and then.
He does, and he pulls it off here. And then Elizabeth Marvel is the third in the siblings that we meet in this film. And so it really is about family dysfunction, sibling dysfunction, and the love of this family. And so this estranged family, they all gather together in New York for an event that's celebrating the artistic work of their father, who's played by Dustin Hoffman. He's the matriarch, but he's one of these guys
Patriarch?
Right? Yes. he's one of these ones who, he's an artist, but he never quite broke through. Mm. So he's very bitter and jealous of the artist that did get to the next level. And so you've got Judd Hirsch shows up.
Judd Hirsch.
And he plays a contemporary to the Dustin Hoffman character who sort of made it to that next level. And Emma Thompson's in it. Candace Bergen's in it for a minute. Rebecca Miller's in it for a minute. Sigourney Weaver has a very brief cameo as herself. But it's it is a just one of those thoughtful, sometimes funny, sometimes bittersweet Noah Baumbach films.
Sounds like perfect.
So
it sounds perfect.
You know, if you liked The Squid and the Whale and Frances Ha, you know, Greenberg, these were movies that I knew. I was sitting here going, this Charlie should be saying this. So while I liked it, it's got, I thought the performances are all very absorbing. Dustin Hoffman spends part of this movie after having a medical incident. And so there are a lot of very relatable scenes of anyone, siblings who've ever had to be in the hospital while trying to advocate in the hospital for the parent who's lying there, and the nurses and the doctors who don't take the time to explain things, and you're drawn to like one nurse over another who seems to be taking better care of your parent. And so there were scenes in here that I think almost any family can absolutely relate to, and so those to me were the best parts of this movie, but it just took a while. It was just a very slow process, and it just takes, it's that sensibility. So it's the same vibe as something like While We're Young. And so that should give you a sense of, if you saw any of those other Noah Baumbach movies and did not like them, you wouldn't like this one either. If you've liked his other stuff, I think you'd like this one as well. And very surprising for Adam Sandler. You know, you don't always think of him in those dramatic roles, but he's good. And Ben Stiller and Elizabeth Marvel, sort of as the other siblings, are also very good.
Well, I can see the pros and cons of Noah Baumbach. I love him more than I don't. I loved Francis Ha, While We're Young, and Mistress America. I really did not like Greenberg. I didn't like Ben Stiller's Greenberg. I would not want to hang out with that guy. And I was in the middle on Squid and the Whale. So he wins more than he loses in my book.
Yeah.
All right, the one I had such an experience this weekend. I saw The Florida Project, and the audience I saw it with was fantastic. There's a group in Washington, D.C. called the Cinema Club, and every Sunday morning they show up at the Avalon, one of the final independent theaters in town, and they see like a limited indie movie that's going to open next Friday, so it's like a sneak preview. 2 weeks ago they saw Lucky, and they more liked it than didn't like it, and this time they saw The Florida Project, and man, they did not like it. Oh man, they did not like it. You could just tell they hated this movie.
I'm not surprised.
It's because they're just... They don't know about the real world anymore. It sounds horrible, but they don't know.
No.
Give me a chance, and then you can just rip my feet out from under me. All right, it's by Sean Baker. We know Sean Baker from Tangerine, one of my favorite films from 2015,
which
was about the transgender actresses working the strip in Los Angeles, and I fell head over heels for that movie. I loved it. So Sean Baker's back, and he's gone to Kissimmee, Florida. Kissimmee, Florida is just next door to Walt Disney World. You can see the fireworks at night. It is next door. But it might as well be just a continent away. It takes place in a real hotel, the Magic Castle Inn. It's painted bright purple, even looks like a castle. But this is where you go when your house is foreclosed on, which is why I thought for a minute you might really like this, because one of your favorite movies from 2014 was 99 Homes.
Absolutely.
You loved 99 Homes. And there's a point there where Andrew Garfield and Laura Dern get kicked out of their house and they move into the hotel, right?
Yes.
This is that hotel, pretty much. And it just stays here. This movie is all about the people in that hotel. And it's about childhood, because our protagonist is 6 years old. Her name's, the actress is Brooklyn Prince, but her name's Mooney. Mooney lives with her mom, who's in her young 20s, who's just, she makes poor life choices. She doesn't have a job. She doesn't want a job. She just needs to somehow, throughout the week, scrape together the $38 a night it takes to stay at the Magic Castle Inn. And the manager of the hotel is Willem Dafoe, the only named actor that Sean Baker has ever cast in any of his movies. His name is Bobby, and he just kind of keeps an eye out for everybody. He knows them better than they know themselves. He knows how they got there, and unlike them, he knows they're never going to leave. They're never going to leave, and he knows the warning signs, and he sees the warning signs with Mooney and her mother. They're just on a downhill trend, and Mooney, she just lives in the present. She's a happy-go-lucky six-year-old. Life couldn't be better for her. I live in a hotel. My neighbors are interesting. There's always something to do. But we see Mooney's future, and it doesn't look so bright. So this is what Sean Baker does. It's hyper real. Mm-hmm. People like this the Cinema Club audience go to the movies to escape. I don't want to think about my problems for the next 2 hours while I'm in this movie.
But do they discuss it afterwards?
They will discuss it next week.
Because my parents belong to a similar type of group. It's Cinema Sundays, the Charles Theater in Baltimore. But they see a movie in Indy, something similar, like Lucky would have been on there. But then they talk about it immediately following.
There was a critic there from Boston who, it wasn't necessarily a Q&A. He read some facts about the film, and there was a microphone involved, but it wasn't like... So yeah, there was a Q&A, but the big one will be next week, and they say, this percentage of you liked it, here's some of your comments. They're going to tear it apart.
I'm sure, but I'm not surprised, because I'm sure I'll get a screener. This is getting a lot of awards buzz.
Especially Willem Dafoe. He is really good.
And so I will watch it, but I remember Tangerine got all this buzz, and that's why I ultimately eventually watched the screener for Tangerine, And I just remember being like, I don't get it. Why would this be awards worthy?
Because he shot it on an iPhone 5.
Right, but just because it was shot on an iPhone 5.
No, I love the character, the transgender actresses you got in their day in the life. It floored me.
But so you're right when you talk about for the folks that are going to, want a little bit of escapism in the movies that they go to see, then this kind of movie is not going to give that to
them.
There
is zero escapism. This is about it's about fictional characters, but these are real people.
Yeah.
Some of the actors he hired are residents of the Magic Castle Inn. Like, one of the main kids lives there with his mom. And the main actress as the mother, he found her off of Instagram. Like, these are not... And she's getting rave reviews. It's like, she's not even acting. She's just acting natural. So the performances are flat out astounding. Now, I a lot of times don't like, I don't know, movies this real. So I just gave this 3 stars. I'm not floored over this movie. I'm not raving about it. I'm not screaming at you to go see this. Because, I love Tangerine better. Now, Christian Hammacher, here's your weekly shout-out, brother. I know he loved this movie way more than Tangerine. And he would tell you to run in the theaters to go see this.
Well, and if he liked it way more than Tangerine, and you love Tangerine, and I did not like Tangerine, I'm thinking I might fall somewhere
I don't
between.
Think you'd like this movie.
I don't think I'll like it either. I will eventually try to see it, but all indications are it is not the type of movie that I would want to spend my time and money to go see, because I don't need to see more real life sometimes. I want to see
Wonder
see
Women.
Something. I want to see Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, and a movie that just sort of goes, wow, that was fascinating. And I'm not so sure that I would get that kind of response from the Florida Project.
All right, our last film is a documentary that you saw at AFI Docs that I did not see. So tell me about Surfing.
Yeah, so Take Every Wave, The Life of Laird Hamilton, is I think popping up in a few places here and there now. And I saw it months ago at the AFI Documentary Festival. And so I just had to look back at my notes to try and remember. All I remembered was that there was some really, really cool footage of waves. And
deep.
That the narrative was a hot mess. And so it's directed by Rory Kennedy. So she's, got some cred for documentaries. But somehow this one just doesn't hang 10 together very well.
Oh,
get that?
God,
I'm sorry. I had to just throw that in there.
It's that Winnie the Pooh looking at you.
It is. It's Pooh. But so, Laird Hamilton is this living legend of the surfing world. And you learn about just his journey from childhood when he was a kid in Hawaii and how he came to take up surfing and then push himself further and further, always needing to catch a bigger wave and trying to revolutionize the sport. And so there are aspects of his story that were certainly unknown and interesting in terms of the technology and the revolutions that he tried to bring to the sport that do not sit well with purists. So a lot of the surfing purists do not like Laird Hamilton, but they also can't deny that he has managed to bring the sport of surfing to a much higher level. And it's a mix of interviews and action. And when you are seeing the amazing footage, I don't know how exactly they got this footage, but Laird and his buddies had taken some footage out on the water and catching these just humongous waves. And so for the surfer dudes and dudettes out there, that's who this movie is for, just to kind of get that that really cool footage that you could not necessarily ever see anywhere else or capture quite the same way as somebody who's actually out there riding the waves can do. So it is, it's for a very limited audience. It's not a great documentary, but some of that footage is spectacular.
It sounds like if you're into that scene, that sport, that hobby, whatever, it sounds like you might want to see it on the big screen just because of the immense pictures and not something you'd want to see on your television.
Yeah, or at least if you have a 60-inch TV, you're probably good. it is definitely one where that footage is really compelling to watch. It's everything else that surrounds it that was a really weak documentary.
All right, to wrap up what's turned into a longer one of our podcasts just because of the amount of films we saw, Happy Death Day will win the weekend. It stinks. Stay away from it.
I don't know why. I don't know why anyone would go see it anyway.
The Foreigner?
The Foreigner, Jackie Chan, go. Pierce Brosnan, if you like them, but you'll forget it the moment you're out of the theater.
Marshall, misleading. It's not about Marshall, per se. It is, day in the life. But Chadwick Boseman, Josh Gad, I'm all for it.
Yeah, courtroom drama. Learn a little bit about the history of Thurgood Marshall.
Professor Marston?
I'll tell you, if you like 50 Shades and Big Love, then those are the two things that you can go, oh, I'm going to love this movie.
Goodbye, Christopher Robin. Only if you want to cry. Otherwise, there's nothing to see here.
Oh, that's sad.
Meyerowitz Story?
If you're a Baumbach fan.
Florida Project if you're a Sean Baker fan or a Willem Dafoe fan.
Yeah.
And Laird Hamilton.
If you surf.
All right. Well, thank you very
much. But we should note that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
We are going to take next week off from podcasting because we're going to be seeing a ton of movies at the Middleburg Film Festival in Virginia.
So it begins, because last year's Middleburg Film Festival was the first time most of us saw La La Land, Moonlight, Lion,
Manchester by the Sea. I mean, it's a chance to load up on all the Oscar buzz films. And I'm actually going to be participating in a roundtable with Greta Gerwig, your buddy.
Whoa!
Yeah, next Sunday. So.
I'm going to see that movie.
Yeah.
But no, I got no FaceTime with Greta Gerwig.
I'm getting some FaceTime.
Noah Baumbach's girl, by the way.
Yeah. So, and in the meantime, we will be seeing a bunch of other movies. I think it's worth noting Only the Brave comes out next week, which will be is a bit about the firefighters who perished in Arizona, which, considering the wildfires going on in Northern California right now, it's just going to be interesting to see how that plays in light of what's happening in the real world.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.